You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 15th, 2021. I'm Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Michelle Maher, antitrust attorney, senior policy fellow at the University of College London for Center for Law and Economic and Society. Her new book, Competition is Killing Us. How big business is harming our society and planet. Also on the program today, the Biden administration plans for the first major tax hike in nearly 30 years to focus on corporations and the rich. Biden, meanwhile, also deploys FEMA to help with unaccompanied child immigrants who are facing incredible deprivation at the border. Cuomo's vaccine czar has also conveniently been in charge of assessing loyalty to the governor. Meanwhile, Chuck Schumer and Senator Gillibrand call for his resignation. White House is looking to tap Jean Sperling, COVID relief czar, as Shalonda Young appears in line for an OMB nomination. Deb Haaland, speaking of which, set to be confirmed as the first Native American cabinet member. Meanwhile, debtors apparently can garnish stimulus checks. The Senate looks for a fix, but don't hold your breath. U.S. is hoarding unapproved AstraZeneca shots, and the EU wants them. The Afghanistan government accepts Taliban peace talks. Representatives Jayapal and Dingell to release a Medicare for All Act this week, and the earmarks are back. And that is a good thing. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, is Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well, Sam. How about you?
I'm fine. I'm a little bit excited about this whole earmarks thing and Medicare for All coming out this week. The earmarks went away 11 years ago, just to remind people, I can't remember exactly how they did the process back then, but essentially what it is today, or would be if it comes back, and it looks like it will. Each representative will have the opportunity to provide the Appropriations Committee with 10 requests of, in this instance, this go around, nonprofit institutions, programs in their district that, or in their state, that they think warrants funding. And this is basically a way, and there's problems with this, of course, because lobbyists used to basically hang out and wait and would sort of midwife these requests. These will be for nonprofits only. So you'll still have some lobbying, and it will be a lot of bank shots for private corporations. Nevertheless, this also is a way to get reticent members of the House and the Senate to vote for a bill. It's a little sweetener. So, for instance, if you can maybe imagine the Joe Manchin Civic Center in West Virginia, that would be nice. I imagine there is a civic center in West Virginia, but maybe there needs to be a bigger one. I don't know, but that's the type of
civic center may sound too Washington-y for him. He needs some sort of, you know, Maverick type.
The Maverick Arena.
Yeah, an arena, right? A sports arena.
That's
he
course.
He wants all that crowd pleasing stuff.
We'll see, but not quite in place yet. But it appears that the Democrats are going to go forward with it. In the meantime, speaking of Democrats, there has been a sort of burgeoning dual track scandal involving Andrew Cuomo in New York State. One is the recording of deaths in nursing homes and the what appears to be proactive attempt to hide the number of deaths in nursing homes, because Andrew Cuomo thought that his political fortunes, and I think he had a lot of designs about ending up in the White House, frankly, were tied to this narrative that he was doing a great job in dealing with COVID in New York State. And a lot of that just came from the fact that there was a complete vacuum of leadership in this country. And he stepped in and played one literally on TV and by performing at these press conferences. And it was comforting to people, I guess, but it was hiding a tremendous amount of incompetence and failure both in the moment, but also failure insofar as he had been cutting Medicaid. He had been cutting public hospitals for a decade, leaving New York particularly vulnerable in this situation. Then, before that scandal subsided in terms of the nursing homes, there was I think we are up to six specific allegations against Andrew Cuomo for sexual harassment. This is not, you know, we had six.
Two for sexual assault, and then I guess four or five, we may be missing one, for at least harassment. So misconduct to varying degrees.
And we should say, this is how the victims have characterized it. This is not, they have characterized it as sexual harassment or assault. As opposed to us sort of embellishing or, characterizing they are characterizing it in this way. And now we have, I think, if not the entire congressional or at least Democratic delegation in the House, pretty close, if not all of them. And the Senate delegation, both Gillibrand and Schumer, coming out calling for Cuomo's resignation. No surprise, but here's Bill de Blasio on Face the Nation characterizing Cuomo's governance as being imperial. And this was before the story came out that Andrew Cuomo's sort of longtime consigliere, who seems to be his buddy. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, like, I think he lives at the governor's mansion. Has been working as the COVID vaccination czar, I believe an unpaid position, coordinating who gets what in the state, which counties get a certain amount. And I can tell you that that varies dramatically from week to week. And apparently, according to some county officials who want to remain anonymous, this czar has been saying things like, "Hey, I'm just calling to take your temperature and see how you're doing on supporting the governor. Just want to know if, like, any of these recent things are going to cause you to come out and say something, you know, negative about the governor. Just want to take your temperature on that. Oh, and also, how many vaccines do you need in your county?" These conversations are unrelated, of course.
Of course.
That's what's going on there. And here is here's Bill de Blasio responding about Andrew Cuomo.
control, we would have done shelter in place.
And I know you want more of that local control as the governor is politically embattled right now. You were one of the first Democrats in New York to call for Andrew Cuomo to resign. Do you actually think he will do that?
I think he'll try to hold out, Margaret. I think he is used to getting things his way, and it's been almost an imperial governorship. But I got to tell you, the folks in this state and the political leadership don't believe him anymore. He doesn't have any credibility. So I think an impeachment proceeding will begin, and I think he will be impeached. And perhaps right before that, he'll decide to resign. That's probably the most likely outcome right now. But I got to tell you something. He should resign right now because he's holding up our effort to fight COVID. He's literally in the way of us saving lives right now.
Do you believe that he and his administration deliberately tried to cover up the scale of nursing home deaths?
I don't have a doubt in my mind. Everything was about his public image. Everything was about his political future. It was not about what people needed. And by the way, it was about campaign contributions. The nursing home industry, the big hospital systems, they gave him millions and millions of dollars. And he went easy on them. And he tried to cover up for everyone, not just him, but his donors. And I think the investigations are going to prove this, Margaret. This was a thoroughly corrupt situation. And he just needs to resign so we can actually turn the page. Mm-hmm. And look, it's an optimistic time, as you started out this morning. It's an optimistic time. We got to put the past behind us. Well, and Andrew Cuomo can't lead us into the future. Well, we've got the people of the state ready to reopen, but we need to get him out of the way to do it.
I want to know about your future. Are you going to run for governor in 2022?
I'm focused right now on fighting COVID and reopening our schools and bringing this city back. That's my focus.
That's not a no, sir.
Look, I'm not worried about the future right now. We're in the middle of a war right here, and we're winning that war. Let me tell you.
I'm not sure that should be his aspiration, but I digress. I don't think that Bill
indeed.
De Blasio would get past a primary.
I agree. But I think the writing's on the wall now for Andrew Cuomo. And people should remember, this is a guy who spent at least one of his terms, just full, like a total of at least 4 or 5 years, making it impossible, ensuring that despite the fact that New York State had voted in more Democratic senators than Republicans in the legislature, made it possible by, and I don't want to go deep into the IDC, but essentially helped enable and create a caucus of Democrats who would caucus with Republicans, preventing any progressive legislation from moving forward in this state, the bluest, if not one of the bluest, if not the bluest in the country, at least in terms of the size and certainly within the context of the size. I mean, New York State should already be leading the country in things like Medicare for all and expansions of child care and of universal pre-K. And the
and
reason
instead,
why
he's
we
cuts
have
Medicaid. Right.
Indeed.
And I just want to quickly add this, like, strong man, the czar, the climate czar, this is not new behavior for him. Cuomo's top aide, Joseph Percoco, I believe is still currently serving a 6-year prison sentence for corruption charges. Cuomo shut down corruption investigations into himself, most notoriously. So these are just some of the scandals that paint a larger picture, a mosaic, if you will, of bullying, of corruption, and of toxicity that Cuomo has gotten away with by behaving like basically an emperor, as de Blasio was alluding to. He exerts his power with brutality, and it's dictatorial, honestly, in the way that he's trying to cement himself here in New York. He's going to go kicking and screaming, but hopefully he goes before his term's up.
Indeed. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michelle Maher about her book, Competition is Killing Us, How Big Business is Harming Our Society and Planet. We'll be right back after this. Folks, today's program sponsored by Magic Spoon. I have a funny Magic Spoon story. So, Emma, you know, I told you, well, let me.
I ran out this morning. I ran out this morning. It's very sad.
I've got a cinnamon deficit, that I'm dealing with, but, Magic Spoon, as you know, this cereal has been sponsoring the program probably over a year now. I don't know. Has all the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. With Magic Spoon, there's 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, and only 140 calories a serving. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free. It's soy free. It's low carb, and it's GMO free. So I'm part of the VIP program. It's not, I mean, you can do it. It's, you just sign up with your phone and they'll tell you when new flavors are coming out. And they have just released 2 new flavors this month, limited time only. I learned my lesson with Ginger Snap, and I wasn't going to get caught flat footed again because I only got a couple of boxes of Ginger Snap, and my kids loved it. I like the Ginger Snap too, actually. So I got the notice, cookies and cream, maple waffle, comforting, indulgent combo, as they call it. I got the cookies and cream. Well, I got both, actually. Saul and I did a taste test. And like, I don't know if I should feel like a bad parent because of this or a good parent. But Saul comes up to me, and, you know, I split my time with the kids. He comes up to me as I'm leaving. He gives me a hug goodbye, and he goes, thank you for getting the cookies and cream cereal. He loves it. He loves it. And I was like, you're welcome. Of course. And then I'm like, wait, why is my kid like thanking me for the cereal? Like, I mean, the cereal is great, but like, have I been depriving my kids so much? But anyways, the point is, my kids love this cereal, and it is awesome to give them a food that they eat on a regular basis that doesn't have sugar. It's delicious. I'm a big fan myself of the cinnamon and the peanut butter and the cocoa. I'm not going to kid. Emma, tastes are a little bit.
I like fruity. And I have. Wait, did I try the cinnamon? I don't know if I. Yes, I did. I like the cinnamon.
We got it right in the office. It's right up there.
Yeah, I know. But I don't like dry cereal like you. Oh. I like it. I like milk in it.
There you go. That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, and if you're listening from Canada, Magic Spoon now ships to Canada too. You will love all of these flavors, delicious stuff, and none of the junk that you're used to. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. You grab the new limited edition cookies and cream, maple waffle, or you can make a custom bundle of cereal and try it today. Be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout. You save $5 off your order. This offer is now good anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, but only when you use our code at checkout. Don't forget to do that. I've done that a couple of times. It's really aggravating. Magic Spoon's so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode and, frankly, my breakfast this morning. Also, now it's time. We're switching seasons. Could be time to look at your wardrobe. I know that I am. Today I was like, I've got to get new clothes. And so I was on Stitch Fix this morning. I haven't made my decisions yet because they give me a whole slate of clothes to choose from. I'm already a member. It offers Stitch Fix offers clothing that's hand selected by expert stylists for your unique size, style, and budget. And it's the easy solution to finding what makes you look and feel your best. You try on pieces at home before you buy, you keep your favorites, you send back the rest. You pay a $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited towards the pieces you keep. There's no subscription required. You can try Stitch Fix once, or you can set up automatic deliveries. Plus, shipping, returns, exchanges, they are easy and free. They give you a prepaid return envelope in your box. Super easy to do. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing for women, for men, and for kids. They ship all over the U.S. They're available in the U.K. too. Stitch Fix got me back into the 5-pocket straight fit pant. They're the ones who did it. I got this Nashville 5-pocket straight fit pant. Prior to that, I was either wearing like like a chino style or my Carhartts. And I don't know. I had not done like, you know, the jean style pant for like decades. And now I'm back into it. They've got me in those chukas. I can't ever pronounce that. And Mila, of course, stole my flannel shirt. But it's a great way to shop for clothes if you're like me and you're not particularly adept at it. And you don't want to necessarily go into a clothing store at this point. Get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. At stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. Stitch Fix Stitch. S-T-I-T-C-H fix.com/majority. And lastly, folks are always trying to sit down, find the time to learn more and better yourself. Sometimes it's how to, sometimes a piece of history. Well, I've got the absolute, if you're like me and don't have much time, I've got the absolute killer app. I mean that like sort of literally and metaphorically. It is called Blinkist. Blinkist for anyone who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. It takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, gathers them together in a 15-minute text and audio explainer. They call it Blinks. And you can use Blinks in a bunch of different ways. You can get into a topic quickly. You can find new topics. You can figure out which books you actually want to spend more time reading or which podcasts you want to spend more time listening to. Blinkist has teamed up with popular podcast creators to blink those for you too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories. They got self-improvement, they got management, mindfulness, and more. You ever had this feeling, Emma, you're walking through an airport and you see that table of like how to's because I don't necessarily go to the how to section when I go into a bookstore. And yeah, most of the bookstores I go to, they don't prominent, but in the airport, it's all right there. And I'm like, I go by it and I'm like, I could learn to be more efficient.
Or
I would be interested in X, Y, or Z, or whatever it is. And and then I was like, but I'm not going to read those things. Well, that's where Blinks comes in. So you get to check out these sort of like books that you feel like, oh, I need to better myself in some fashion, but I'm not going to read all the prose. Sorry, I'm just not going to. But and it's actually happened. The Tim Ferriss book that I blinked, I ended up reading the whole book because of it. But you could check out a book like The Barefoot Investor by Scott Pape, give you a sense of like investing. I don't know if you would read it, but also, but to get the key takeaways, Blowout by Rachel Maddow. Maybe you need to go into social circles or situations, work situations where you should know what's in that book.
Right.
And that's the way you update it like that. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. You start your 7-day free trial. You get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist.com/majority report. You get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. All right. Let's get into it. I want to welcome to the program Michelle Marr. She is an antitrust lawyer, senior policy fellow at the University College of London Center for Law, Economics, and Society, and author of Competition is Killing Us, How Big Business is Harming Our Society and Planet, and What to Do About It. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start with actually your story about how you changed your mind about the free market. I mean, I don't think I like to think anyways, the vast majority of our audience is extremely skeptical at worst of the free market. I'm skeptical, frankly, of even the existence. I think the term is misleading, but tell me how you had your revelation.
Yeah, so I mean, my book is really based on my work as an antitrust attorney. And if we kind of go back to 2013, I was busy working at a big law firm in London, helping companies really get their mergers approved. And I say get their mergers approved because that is what the system does. We don't generally block very many mergers at all. So, you know, I was kind of there busy working in that system. And the background to that is I was actually a teenage Thatcherite, conservative, you know, neoliberal. I really genuinely went into this field of antitrust law thinking that competition serves the world, you know, let's make world markets more competitive. And I really had a light bulb moment. I think you could really call it a crisis of conscience, where I understood that even on its own terms, this system that is supposed to be making markets more competitive and spreading, you know, the benefits of free market capitalism more broadly, actually, you know, the markets are becoming more concentrated. You know, I didn't really have the language to describe it then, because it's only really in the last couple of years that we've seen the real kind of economic evidence proving that industries are becoming more concentrated. But really, the evidence was there for kind of anybody who's been awake and, you know, watching, you know, the tech industry, big pharma, big banks and so on. But it's really kind of breaking out of a mindset, I suppose, because, you know, to get into that industry, to you know, do that profession, you really have to believe that, that you're doing, you know, serving a broader purpose. And so I had this kind of moment where I started to really question, you know, why is it that this system of corporate capitalism seems to concentrate, you know, wealth and power in so few hands and yet spread its harms so very widely? And that's really what brought me to write my book.
So you outline six myths of market capitalism, in the book. Let's go through those. The first being that free markets are competitive.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is one of the, you know, the basic premise, which is that if you leave markets free, they will be competitive and competition will allow the, you know, best allocation of resources across the economy. It's like kind of the fundamental principle of why we want free markets in the first place. And as I mentioned, you know, over the last few years, really, we've been getting, you know, evidence and that market after market is actually much more highly concentrated, even than, you know, the experts think. I would say even the experts actually, I think lay people are very aware of how concentrated markets are. But the interesting thing about the kind of technocratic elite that are responsible for regulating markets is that they don't see concentration where everybody else sees it. So they hesitate to call any particular company a monopoly. There's this idea that actually there's, you know, more competition than it seems. You know, Google says that they're facing fierce competition from Facebook and so on. So we would say we're not a monopolist. You know, as Amazon, as Jeff Bezos said in his testimony before Congress, you know, we are, you know, we're just in the retail industry. We just have like a couple of percent of this retail industry, saying that he competes with every single other person who's trying to sell you anything, which I suppose speaks to his level of ambition. But it's not a realistic understanding of how powerful Amazon is. And really the kind of, it's the power has really disappeared from our language and from our understanding. So this myth that markets are competitive is just not true.
I may step on, like, you know, some of the myths as we go, but isn't it also the case that in addition to free markets not being competitive, that there's no such thing as a free market, right? I mean, like, these markets are all constructed and we're always making governments are making a decision on how they're going to construct the market from the get-go. I mean, decisions can evolve at different times. And certainly we have a market, and we're going to talk more about that, as we have governments that are constructing markets in a way that are less competitive, but they construct, there is no market that is not, and certainly, you know, in the modern era, I mean, I'm sure we can find you can find a village somewhere where obviously there, you know, but even then there's still like rules, right? Like you got to put your cart over here as opposed to over there. When you're selling, there's no such thing as a free market. And that means that there's always necessarily winners and losers who are being chosen in those markets. Isn't that the case?
I absolutely agree. And I think that this is one of, you know, the kind of coup really in this kind of whole narrative around free markets is this, this, you know, meta myth that markets can even be free, because even to create a market, as you say, you know, the government needs to be involved, or the state needs to be involved, the courts, et cetera, upholding your contracts, you know, in order for you to even have confidence that you can interact with another buyer or with a seller, you know, you need to be able to know that there is, you know, some basis on which you're contracting. So yeah, I absolutely agree. I suppose what's interesting is that, and this is maybe where I depart a little bit from some of the activists and campaigners in the monopoly space or anti-monopoly space in the US, is this understanding that, you know, what is the role of government? And, you know, I think that what is maybe not understood is that antitrust is effectively industrial policy. You know, governments are effectively choosing which companies have to compete in the economy and which are given the privilege of being able to merge or collaborate with their rivals. And one of the new principles of my work that I'm really trying to kind of develop is this idea that competition is not always good. So I think that there's this idea that, you know, we have these big monopolies, you know, in these constructed markets, governments have effectively allowed them through intellectual property, through, you know, licensing, all sorts of different ways that that they've been allowed to gather up their monopoly power. And there's this idea that as long as we have kind of introduced more competition into that market, constructed as it is, the outcomes will be better. And one of the things I really try and draw out in the book is the fact that actually you can't have too much competition. And also competition is not a blanket solution. So if you have a monopoly, for example, a monopsony, it's a terrible word, but you know, monopoly buyer power, for example, over your workers or suppliers, it's not the case that necessarily, you know, only more competition is the only solution. You might also want to raise up the power of those workers, for example,
right,
allowing them not to compete, which is also known as allowing them to unionize. So that, you know, there's other ways in which you might want to change that market. But I suppose the kind of core principle is that the state should be comfortable and confident in entering into markets, participating in them and intervening, because actually they're doing it already. And even if they claim that they're going to kind of stand back and let the market do whatever it wants, there's always the kind of, you know, invisible hand of the state, if you like, that's actually kind of propping up the different actors. So no, I absolutely agree. I think that it's a really important point.
And I argue that to the extent that we have an invisible hand of the government, it is a project to make that hand invisible, because then if it's not invisible, then it becomes quite obvious that this is actually a choice, that these are decisions that are being made as opposed to, you know, them happening naturally. And if they're decisions being made, then they are subject to all our members of society sort of participating in that decision. And I think there's a lot of interest of a narrow set of people in our society to not have that be the case, to make it as if like this stuff is natural and there's no decision being made here. All right. Well, let's get to your other myth, which is companies compete to serve society. Who believes that? Tell us why it's a myth.
I mean, I suppose that's what's interesting about a lot of these myths, is that I think a lot of people instinctively know that this is not the case. But the point is that when it comes to economic policymaking and, you know, policymaking at the very top, these are the arguments that are wheeled out. Right. And, you know, you get one and then you can kind of talk it down, and then you get the other filling it in. So this idea is that, you know, we have these innovative companies and they are out there trying to produce, you know, please that delight their customers, produce the best possible products for the cheapest price. And of course, that would be a fantastic thing, and it would be a brilliant way to make money if you could do it. But there are also these other ways that you can make money. One is by monopolizing a market, cornering it, leveraging your power so that you can increase the price. And another way is to shift costs onto society. So if I'm Uber, I could pay for employee benefits for my drivers, or I could allow society to pick up the costs of, you know, people who don't have any sick pay and any, you know, whatever other rights. And within antitrust, there's this kind of very naive understanding of how companies operate. We actually don't look inside a company. It's, you know, these companies are kind of out there on the market. We don't look inside. If we were to look inside, we'd be faced with the obvious truth, which is that many companies operate to maximize profits for shareholders. So what does that do? It drives them to pursue monopolization and the externalization of costs to try and push as many costs out onto society as possible. And, you know, that's why we have these kind of amazing statistics about how much of the wealth that is, you know, sitting there in the stock exchange, how much of it is due not to, you know, innovation and so on, but it is really tech monopoly wealth. And it's precisely the power of companies to, you know, to leverage their power against suppliers, against customers. That's where the wealth comes from. That's really where the profits come from. And they're not being passed on as, you know, benefits to consumers. They are being passed up to shareholders.
Well, that's one of the threads in your book, right? The emphasis on shareholder capitalism that's become so dominant over the past few decades with the rise of neoliberalism, many people attribute it to or call it that. Can you expand on that emphasis and why that has kind of buttressed the dominance of these monopolies, not called monopolies, in capitalism that you outline?
Yeah, I mean, I think that essentially, if you think about how investors are going about their investment strategies, you know, investing in a monopoly is extremely lucrative because you are able to essentially guarantee your returns. And you've got a company that is able to, you know, touching on some of the other myths, one of the third myth is that corporate power is benign, but actually with the backing of investors and, you know, with the backing of, you know, the BlackRocks of the world, the kind of ultimate investors, companies are able to go out there and leverage their economic power that they earn through, through cornering markets and so on. And they can leverage it into political power. And I think this is probably, I'm speaking from London. We have this problem for sure in Europe. I would say it's much worse in the US, the ability to actually influence government and to, you know, after Citizens United, you've got this kind of human right to express yourself through political spending. We don't quite have those problems here, but you also have the issues of the revolving door, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of interplay around, you know, the shaping of ideas, what's acceptable. It was one of the things that I found most interesting, you know, leaving big law and leaving the kind of antitrust world is really, you know, again, breaking that mindset. Is it okay to say that these things are wrong? And, you know, as you say, like many of your viewers will be thinking, well, this is obvious, but I cannot tell you how not obvious it is to the people who are entirely responsible.
That point, and I know that's not necessarily the point of your book, but that point I think is really instructive to people when they understand, when we look at, in the context of our government, when we look at like the personnel that end up being in our government, from where they came is indicative, not necessarily like, you know, whether they're nice people or what their agenda is necessarily, but it gives you a sense of their worldview. That within the world of big law, nobody there thinks they're doing something that's bad. And I've had conversations with people, whether it's like in the finance industry or in big tech or whatever, they all think that they understand what they're doing better than anyone outside of that world, that everyone else is just sort of lay people without any understanding of what's going on there. And they all think they're doing good. They all think that they're doing what is ultimately going to be best for society. And I mean, that is really the challenge because they don't, there's no doubt in my mind, there are people within corporations who make decisions that are like, they know is wrong, But broadly speaking, I think most people think like, oh, what I'm doing is actually the way that society functions. And of course, you and I'm greasing the wheels. And they are true believers. And I wanted to just touch on this whole notion and just to go back. I mean, that's just sort of like a side note. And I think that is, you know, that's a book in and of itself, it seems to me. But this notion of and here in this country, we had a radical change in the entire sort of definition of what constituted antitrust and non-competition, you know, in the 70s, or I should say the early 80s with Reagan adopting the Borkian notion of what constituted monopolies and antitrust. And it was completely focused on consumers. But you talk about that companies compete to provide for shareholder value exclusively. And you later say one of your myths is that they're not legally bound to do this. I want you to address that, but also the concept of like what has also happened in this country because of the concept of stock buybacks and because of our tax code and the way that executives are compensated. Their compensation is now more directly tied to the shareholder value, and because they are big shareholders, and that's where a big chunk of their compensation comes from. So will you address both the lack of legal obligation for corporations to just maximize shareholder value, and B, the concentration of shareholder power amongst the people who are in charge of the companies? I mean, I've put it in the sense that they have a cottage industry, like they have a side bet on the company, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with the 5-year or 10-year or 20-year success of a corporation, but rather what's going to maximize their personal profits, their personal compensation in a short period of time. And those are not necessarily aligned interests.
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't take long. You know, you don't have to take a whole like course in US corporate law. There's really only a couple of cases that look at, you know, the obligations of directors and whether they have an obligation to maximize shareholder value. And there are some very narrow instances. So, you know, when a company is being sold in a hostile takeover, yes, the directors have some kind of obligation to accept a reasonable price, you know, for the shares of the company. But in the day-to-day managing, you know, in almost every other situation, directors are given enormous latitude in order, you know, to run the company. No court is going in there and saying, you know, are you taking, you shouldn't really be paying your workers a little bit more because, you know, are you really maximizing shareholder value? And in fact, it's almost impossible for shareholders to sue. You know, there are tons of suits that get thrown out of court because, again, the courts don't want to intervene. So why then do we have this, you know, ironclad norm that that directors do have to maximize shareholder value? Well, one thing is, you know, it's what the business press says, it's what people learn in business school, you know, how am I going to serve the shareholders? But it's also exactly as you say, almost because directors could do something else, they could maximize something else. Of course, you know, the system has developed a load of mechanisms to ensure that they don't, that they will maximize shareholder value. And the most powerful one, as you say, is tying executive compensation to the share price, actually paying people in shares, and therefore they become a shareholder. And this is actually one of the you know, really interesting things. If you look at the you know, origins of this idea that the companies, the directors should serve their shareholders, this was a kind of democratic principle. The idea was that you had these powerful managers and left to their own devices, they could basically run a company however they want, better to, you know, make them answerable to the mass of shareholders. But of course, now the mass of shareholders, the ones who are really, you know, influential, is essentially the directors themselves, because they are, you know, very important shareholders that they get to, you know, commune with every day. And then, you know, the big asset managers, the ones that have the kind of 4 or 5% of block holding shares. So their interests get served. So do the interests of the directors themselves and management themselves. But other than that, you know, this idea that they should be serving shareholders. I mean, who are the shareholders? shareholders now, I think the average tenure of a shareholder is something like 4 months. So these are kind of, you know, and you get like high frequency trading type shareholders. Shareholders are not sticking around. So the idea that you would be serving them and not, for example, you know, the employees who are coming in day after day, even your customers, even the communities that are kind of around your companies, it makes absolutely no sense. And it is not the law.
Well, stock buybacks, I feel like, completely undercut that democratization myth, right? What with the accumulation of those stocks and the concentration of them and the fact that this practice has become so normalized. I mean, here in the States, we've had Democrats like the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, in the past has spoken out against stock buybacks, but it still hasn't been a talking point that's, I guess, been internalized by people, because I think it's a bit of a myth to a lot of folks. So can you just expand on that practice and how that's kind of exacerbated a lot of the inequities and difficulties that you've touched on in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think the phenomenon of stock buybacks really speaks to how public companies have become a pure financial asset to be pumped for all the you know, returns that they can be squeezed out of them. So you get a company, it takes on a whole bunch of debt, and then instead of investing in the company or, you know, trying to actually make it grow as you might if you were kind of running a real business, instead you're actually in the business of kind of channeling money upwards. So you pay it out in a stock buyback. You buy back all of kind of a proportion of your company's shares from the shareholders and giving them, you know, a nice return. So, you know, shareholders, of course, should expect a return. That's what dividends are for. And, you know, they should be getting some kind of income. They are, you know, serving a purpose to the company, injecting money when the company lists its shares, for example. But there is no kind of principle that the kind of the argument that they should be able to get this extra payoff, that they should be able to regularly be able to assume that companies will, you know, chuck them, you know, tens of millions of dollars being paid out regularly. I mean, it really speaks into, you know, this is why I say this is kind of like a web of myths, because you've got this myth that shareholders are the ones who are kind of out there spotting the best investment opportunities in the economy. So we should give them the money because then they'll be able to, you know, see like what's the next up and coming sector, when really what they're doing is, you know, seeing which tiny little bit of profit is out there to be had, and then kind of squeeze it out of that sector and then move on to another company. So again, this speaks to, you know, where is, if there's no loyalty from the shareholder side, why should companies be serving them? And certainly the phenomenon of stock buybacks really has no kind of principle underneath it.
And we should say, up until 1982 in this country anyways, they were illegal. They were just considered manipulating the stock price. And just by, you know, an SEC rule change, they became legal. And you had a way of basically just juicing the price of your stocks, which is very helpful if you are a CEO and your compensation is a function of the stock value. And also, you happen to know that your capital gains tax is significantly lower than your wage tax, and so you take most of your compensation in the form of capital gains, and then we're off to the races. One of your other myths is well, I think we've touched on inequality in stock and shareholder wealth. But just lastly, talk about the markets are self-correcting. I mean, again, I think in the context of our audience, you know, I think people have a fairly jaundiced perspective on that. But for those people who are stumbling by and still believe the idea that markets are self-correcting, are they?
Well, I mean, I suppose the reason why it's so interesting, almost kind of excavating some of these myths, is because although they may seem, you know, obviously wrong today, it was a it was the kind of bedrock on which the Borkian, ideas were really built. It was this idea that, okay, yes, in theory, in the textbooks, you can get a monopoly, but monopolies are self-defeating. You know, if a company was to go out there and abuse its market power, say it earns, you know, really high profits, then, you know, the rivals will come flooding in and there's just no way for a monopoly to persist. So this idea that markets would self-correct was really an excuse to, or is effectively saying to the government, don't intervene. You know, the most that you can do is distort markets. You might intervene where you think that something's going on, but really that market's about to self-correct. And so actually, you know, government action is worse than whatever, you know, temporary problem that we can perceive with the market. Obviously, you know, we know that's not correct. It kind of marvels me that it takes, like, you know, people winning Nobel Prizes to prove it. But, you know, you get people like Joseph Stiglitz and others who've really shown that actually, as we all know, you know, once a company is able to earn those incredible profits, what it's then able to do is entrench that position. It can build a moat, it can build a wall around itself, it can throw, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars at lawyers to really make sure that all of their protections and IP and et cetera are in place, make sure that it can get all of its mergers approved. And, you know, there we go. We've got a kind of growing monopoly. You know, what the Borkian kind of myth really achieved was it effectively disappeared those ideas. So here I'm there pointing at monopoly and Bork is saying that doesn't exist. Like, I mean, what you're talking about doesn't exist. And so, you know, where are we in our discourse then?
That's what's fascinating, is that they simply changed the definition of what abusing a monopoly means, right? I mean, prior to Bork, it meant you are not serving the community. You are not allowing for other competitors in the marketplace. You are, and then only one component of it was the price that consumers were paying. But there's a whole sort of array of issues that are implicated by a monopoly. And he just now, you know, but that era just essentially narrowed what that was so that it just became a question of price. And even if you were to get to price at this point, at that point, you're so far gone because the bar to entry has been raised so high by having one dominant player. It's still problematic. Let's look at, and you write about the solutions, and I've spoken to a lot of people about monopoly and antitrust over the years in this country. And almost all of them say a similar thing, that we don't really need to have new laws. We just need to interpret the laws like we used to interpret the laws. What is your perspective on that? You have a suggestion for a little bit more sort of like a statutory additions as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm all for, you know, enforcing the laws as we have them. I, however, think they come with all of this impenetrable baggage. So I think it's really difficult to just say to courts, enforce the law as it's already written, as you've already been doing, but the opposite. So I think it's really difficult to, you know, move forward. It would be much easier, of course. So, you know, I, along with everybody else, will say that if we can do that, great. I would say, however, that there's enough reason to think that the courts will be kind of baffled and confused, and that actually what will end up doing is continue to talk at cross purposes. Like, we don't really have very good shared understanding of what competition is, what is bad competition, what is good competition. So a lot of what I'm arguing is really about centering power and, you know, taking actively identifying power. So power is pretty much absent from neoclassical economics. So let's actually look at power, let's understand how it operates. And then if we can identify power, we should be dispersing it. We can use, the traditional tools to do that. We can break up companies. We can unwind mergers. We can, prevent the future accumulation of power. If we can't disperse the power, then we should look at different ways of counterbalancing that power. So we mentioned, we talked about unions earlier. We could look at other ways to build up stakeholder power. Those are kind of the different counterparties that are otherwise suffering. And then in the most extreme example, if you can't disperse the power and you can't counterbalance it, then we're in this situation where we should start to think about dissolving power. So when companies effectively breach their public interest pact, their kind of social contract with the public, and they're not serving the public interest, then why should they get all the benefits of limited liability, low corporation tax, etc.? They should actually have to either produce benefits for the public or be dissolved. And I mean, this is something that it's not, it's kind of connected to some of the proposals from Elizabeth Warren and the Accountable Capitalism Act, the idea of having federal chartering. Companies are, a social construct. They're a legal construct, constructed by the market, and we actually, by the state, and we have the power to control them and to get rid of them if we want to.
Let's just talk about that for a moment, because I find that fascinating. So the idea, and I agree with you, I mean, people should really need to internalize the idea that corporations do not exist in nature. They exist because we allow them to exist. Every element of what a corporation can or cannot do has been a choice that has been made by government, that has been undoubtedly influenced by people who want them to make a certain choice one way or another. And people can just figure out who's had more influence in that process. When you talk about like dissolving a corporation, I mean, people freak out like, oh my God, like what would you do? But we have a mechanism that exists already for that. Right. And that it's just that we allow that dissolution of a corporation to be determined by creditors at this point, but we could do it as a society, and it would be, I mean, you could theoretically just do it through a bankruptcy process, right? Will you just speak to that idea? Because this sounds like a crazy radical idea to people, but we could have standards that say, like, if you hit a certain threshold and you do not begin to, in some way, dissolve parts of your power voluntarily, they're rarely going to do it, or they're going to try and find a loophole or whatever. I mean, we have these, we broke up the telephone company in this country. We've done it before. We broke up Microsoft in some respects. But another way of doing it is like some like hybrid notion of like a bankruptcy proceeding. Will you just walk us through that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, that's exactly how it used to work. When you would go and get your license to incorporate, it came with all sorts of restrictions about how much debt you were allowed to take on and which other industries you were allowed to enter. And if you breached those terms of your license, then you got that license revoked. And that power still exists. The state attorneys general, I think, in almost all of the states in the US, and we have a similar thing in the UK, which sits under bankruptcy law. It sits in our insolvency law, and it's used quite regularly against Ponzi schemes and financial scams. It's not generally used against solvent companies, but I suppose it's this kind of real asymmetry that anybody can start a company. It's the easiest thing to do. You could do it online. It'll take 10 minutes. And then you have this license to exist forever and do whatever is within the law. But of course, the more power you get to decide what is in the law, what suits yourself. And there's no end. And it's kind of a bizarre concept, really, that we're not actually exercising our ability to effectively say to companies, you've breached the terms. You are no longer allowed to exist. And realistically, I think most companies, would get, if they got close to that brink, would start to kind of act pretty differently. And, if I think about, say, the oil and gas industry, we have an industry that is finally starting to kind of own up to the enormous harms that have been caused through its profit making, based on knowledge of the impact of human created climate change that these actors had themselves in the 70s. So they've been sitting on this information for like 30 or 40 years. If, however, sitting on top of this whole regulatory system, they knew that there are actual kind of ability to exist and continue to make profits was at risk, then that information would have come about, come to light much quicker, because you would have this, how could any one oil or gas company know that the other one wasn't going to break this information out if there was the possible risk that the regulator could turn around and say, well, we don't need oil and gas companies anymore.
What if, and we just have a couple minutes left here, but I'm curious in pursuing this. What if the answer to that. I mean, I understand, like, you know, with that regulation, they would feel it's sort of almost like competition to be the, you know, the one that survives, because they're going to actually cop to this notion. But what if we get to that point? And I mean, and maybe we're talking about a completely different ideological, battle here. But what if we get to that point and we realize, like, oh, these companies are highly problematic to society. And but there's a claim that we desperately need this this energy. What if we nationalize it? What if we nationalize those corporations? They are they're you know, people say it's a national security issue. OK, well, if it's a national security issue, maybe the nation should run it. And we run that thing, and then we figure out a way to do a safe off ramp from something that is literally killing the planet and the society that we live in that planet. And we should just nationalize these corporations in these different sectors. I mean, what you're talking about is not necessarily mutually exclusive, that notion.
Absolutely not. And I think this is why it's important not to just assume that competition is the only solution. Actually, we have a whole range of solutions, and the actual goal is not competition per se. It's about, do we have a balance of power within the economy that is being maintained? And is that overall organization of the economy serving the public interest? So, you know, one of the projects that I'm now part of, I'm starting an organization called the Balanced Economy Project. And it's really about fostering these other ideas. You know, we have this kind of very empty discourse that is effectively kind of capitalism or socialism without kind of looking at what is it, you know, what are the different kind of flavors of capitalism, flavors of socialism that we already have, by the way, because, you know, we don't have any kind of, pure version of those. What organization do we want, and who do we want to be in power? So I say that we need a massive kind of democratic deficit. We need to be looking at how to disperse power, how to actually enable different stakeholders to have a say over these enormous resources that are really shaping lives and the economy and, you know, the future of the planet. We need to have a way that you don't have just, you know, some companies, or you don't have just Larry Fink at BlackRock deciding, okay, now it's time that all my investee companies should be serving the future. Like, why does he get to decide when is the time? We should never be in that position. Although, of course, I hope that he does put pressure on his companies now to make changes to combat climate change. But it's about kind of democracy, really, and it's about leveling up the power within the economy.
Well, Michelle Marr, I'm interested to hear more about what that organization comes up with. In the meantime, the book is Competition is Killing Us, How Big Business is Harming Our Society and Planet and What to Do About It. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you both.
All right, folks, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with the end of this program. Gotta say, a couple of things that I found really interesting about her perspective, because it's interesting to hear an antitrust person from, you know, who, I mean, she's obviously, I think, educated or spent part of her time in the United States. She's can practice law in both the United States and in Great Britain. But it's interesting to see that perspective, someone coming from that antitrust world, but who also has a broader set of arrows in her quiver, as it were, where the idea of where, and this is what I think is really sort of interesting about that, the antitrust people we've talked to over the years, it is very much about a question of power. And discussing antitrust makes you start to ask questions that lead you to bigger answers than just antitrust regulation. And that is, how do we deal with power imbalances in our society? And it was refreshing to talk to someone who talks about antitrust, but is also willing to say, like, you know, part of that power imbalance could be addressed by things like nationalization, or maybe that's because she's European and those things don't seem to be such boogie things.
Well, you don't necessarily hear somebody, an expert, arguing for variations of both, really. It's usually an antitrust expert or someone who's more focused on nationalizing things in general, which I thought was really, you know, a great perspective.
Exactly. Indeed. All right. Well, we're out of time for today, but we'll be back tomorrow. We got a lot more to talk about. I also want to talk about that true believer element, but not happening today. We will see you tomorrow. And
just kidding.
Oh, apparently, are we switched today? Has Zoom switched us?
Well, remember, I was having those technical difficulties that put me in such a lovely mood before the show.
And so you got in late. Mm-hmm. Is there no way for me to just to switch?
I mean, why do I need to be on the left this time around? I mean, it's like we're not in studio.
It's very disconcerting to people.
We're not in studio together, so. But when we are, we got it. We have to be in
the same. It's the same problem. It doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter where we're located because we're on separate. People don't understand. Even when we're sitting 5 feet from each other, we're on separate feet. This is one of the things that people just don't understand about our production now, is that we have much less control over some of the technical aspects because we are remote, because we're doing it over Zoom. And there are other options out there that we could use to do replacements. But there are downsides that we're also concerned about those things. So this is where we're at until we ultimately one day, hopefully soon, get back into the office. But it is really, I'm getting these IMs where people are like very concerned.
I'm so sorry. I did not mean to, you know, provide a glitch in the matrix or something like that
there's a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah.
That's exactly what
that must be it.
You have created a glitch in the matrix. Folks, we're going to head to the fun half of the program. We have lots to talk about, and now I shouldn't even point it out because now people are really, it's all.
I feel like we've ruined some people's days.
25 minutes of IMs talking about this dynamic. Folks, just a reminder. I'm not gonna read the email. I'm not gonna point out the person. We have people who leave the show because of financial reasons. We always provide them an opportunity to work out a deal with us for their membership, because I don't want to lock anybody out for monetary reasons. And then we have people who sometimes say, like, you know, for whatever reasons, I need to get away from politics for a while or something to that effect. That happens. I get an email about why they were someone was canceling their membership of the show. And they said, because I'm not critical enough on the COVID reporting. I'm not critical of the reports
COVID relief bill.
No. On COVID.
You're getting canceled for COVID reporting?
Sam, I don't think there's one person who wants to get more into the nitty gritty of the pandemic than you.
The opposite.
Oh.
Yeah.
That I am not critical. I am not enough of a skeptic of COVID. Like, imagine what is going through someone's mind where you have 530,000 people dead. It's probably higher than that.
There's reporting today.
It's definitely higher. Yeah.
I mean,
sorry, Brendan,
they're finding
new
undercounts. There's undercounts. Yeah. And you're not critical enough about why people aren't going back into school. I mean, the bottom line is we have not had the resources. We're not going to get the resources. It's going to be easier in spring, no doubt. But they say you to change the air in a school 5 times an hour for people to go in safely. Every time you hear anybody say, we can bring people back into schools, that you wait for the if. You circle the if, and then you look at everything that comes after that if. You underline it, and you say, have we done this? Have we done that? Have we done this? So I will tell you right now, here's my point. If you think that I have not been contrarian enough about COVID, the existence of COVID, whether you should get vaccinated, whether it's safe for people to go back into school or work at this juncture, or throughout, and certainly prior to now, do me a favor. Quit the show. Or let me know who you are and I will fire you from the show. Like that's like, I mean, honestly.
Sam, I don't know. I think you need to be more cognizant of your potential conflicts of interest being bought off by coronavirus.
By the virus.
Right. I mean, let alone the big pharma, which was already been going on for years.
It's the mask industry.
That's why you didn't support the mask industry. Force the vote. Yeah, the vaxxers.
Mask industry.
Yeah, we started profiting on those masks.
It's exactly. It's big immigration because the proceeds from those masks went to the Northwest immigration.
Soros plan.
What's that?
I said you're a Soros plant.
Exactly. But I'm being serious here. I mean, if you are listening to the audience and look, if you want to have some COVID skepticism, that's your business. But if you are going to tell me that you're going to quit the show because of I am not skeptical enough of the mainstream COVID reporting, then I've got some very bad news for you in terms of
there are a lot of people who want one size fits all things yesterday, right? Or recently, geez, like how you know, the COVID relief bill can't be good because the Democrats put it through, and obviously the Democrats are failures, which yes, traditionally they are, but that doesn't fit into my narrative, and I want to be skeptical of the mainstream media, so everything has to be fitting into that square hole.
I think there are a lot of things to be skeptical about the COVID bill and this and that. I think that's helpful, but this this specific subsection, I would say bye bye. All right. I guess Nomi's not doing her show today. Check it out tomorrow, and we're putting the best of Nomi's thing. We're carrying it on our YouTube channel now, so folks can check that out as well. We post that on the weekends. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian audio universe? Of audio and video. I don't know why I say audio.
Yeah, it is kind of mainly video lately. Left Reckoning Thursday. This Thursday, we're going to have Victor Poggi, a Intercept journalist based in Rio de Janeiro, on to talk about Lula being cleared to run for president. So yeah, check that out at 8 Eastern on YouTube.
Is it Poggi or is it Poggi as in poggers?
It could be Poggi. Well, I'll ask him that.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. I'm going to turn on the phones right now. I'm not going to make this. I'm not going to blow it today. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back.
Back, 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 back. Boy is back.
And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
and the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.